Chapter 2, Graduation. The boy grew up in a universe of macrocosm and microcosm. To visit the other side of the world was to him what swinging on a vine across a creek was for other boys. He could see the unending dramas of underground ant colony wars and stratospheric weather front competitions as easily as he saw the mail truck barreling past the farm into town twice a day. He could alter his visual perceptions to detect waves on the entire electromagnetic spectrum, seeing alpha particles or cosmic rays as easily as he saw the visible light, but in colors that ordinary humans were incapable of imagining. He could feel the level of the day's sunspot activity when he woke up in the morning, in much the same way that those around him could tell if it was raining before they opened the shades. He could hold a conversation in one room while he listened to another one a mile away and to a radio broadcast as it flew through the air around him in microwaves. The world was his playground and campus, superhuman senses his teachers, the anonymity of the Ken home, his womb and protection. He was alone in all this sense and knowledge, monumentally alone. But less alone, he realized, than were those other Earthmen glued to their work and trapped inside bodies that could do no more than touch the outsides of other bodies. The boy was alone, but he was never bored. Jonathan Kent had sold the farm for less than it was worth, bought the general store in Smallville from Old Wizard Barnes for more than it was worth, and moved into a little clapboard house he couldn't afford next door to Sarah and Martin Lang. Young Maynard Stone, the former backyard turkey entrepreneur, was now John M.K. Stone, the chief loan officer at the Smallville branch of Heartland Bank and Trust. Young Stone floated a loan to Jonathan for 10 years, betting on Clark's eventual ability to pay it off. That was the way people did business in Smallville, especially with a man whose smile was as infectious as Jonathan Kent's. Clark was 13 when he sat on the school bus and stared through the window at the installation ceremony for a new queen bee in a hive 4 miles away. Lana sat next to him and talked incessantly about how incredibly old Clark Gable was starting to look, and how she couldn't understand why her mother said he was such a hunk every time she saw a picture of him in a magazine. And was Clark listening to her?
"Yeah, Lana. Clark Gable's a hunk. Mostly I like his name."
"Oh, Clark, you're always daydreaming. I don't know why I talked to you at all."
"No, I was listening, Lana. Honest," he said,
as the new queen's nuptial flight carried her above all the drones but one. Clark turned to look at the girl, taking an instant to notice her incredible red hair for the 712th time, and said,
"You said that he's nearly 60 and his wife at home is pregnant and he's filming a movie somewhere out of the country with Marilyn Monroe and every woman your mother's age is drooling for him all the time, and you don't see how his poor wife can handle even looking at a man like that because he's so old and presumably overrated and outside the country with Marilyn Monroe, and I suppose I agree completely."
Clark smiled the way his father smiled. If people knew he was adopted, they had very likely forgotten by now. And Lana let out a deep breath and said, "Oh, Clark," and the bus driver slammed on his brake. They were on the Totten Pound Road, on a little hill that was the highest point for 50 miles, and the window on the right side of the bus looked out over Smallville. If Clark pointed the fingers of his right hand upward, with his thumb on the gold-leaf town hall bell tower and his ring finger on the point of the light-blue steeple of the old Methodist church, then the span of his hand held the entire town. Clark looked up when the bus stopped short. So did Lana and the 31 other kids on their way to school in the morning. The driver threw the handle to open the double door and hopped out. The 15 kids on the left side of the bus gaped out their windows and said things like "wow" and "aw" and "oh, the poor thing." And the 18 kids on the right side got out of their seats to see what was going on. "This old fellow look familiar to any of you kids?" the driver wanted to know. The driver was kneeling next to his left front wheel, gently stroking the fur of an ancient black Labrador retriever, dying or dead, who had just been hit by that wheel. Clark gulped, looked at the dog thoroughly from his vantage point on the bus. The animal was not breathing, its heart was still. Its brain still radiated electromagnetic energy, but it would not be doing that for long. It probably died of shock the moment the bus hit it. There was nothing Clark or anyone else could do for it. "That's Tim," Pete Ross said, "the dog that lives in the chicken coop on the Johnson farm."
"Is that Tim?" somebody said.
"Aw," somebody said. "There was so much dust on the road," the bus driver said, "that I didn't see him until I was almost on top of him. He just stood there, didn't even try to get out of the way."
"Mr. Johnson said he had arthritis," somebody said.
The driver wrapped the old dog in his coat and put him under his seat, saying that he would take the animal to the Johnson farm as soon as the students were all at school. The rest of the ride was uncommonly quiet. Halfway through the morning,
All the students who were on the bus except for Clark seemed to have forgotten the incident. Clark left school that day at lunchtime.